I'm Faith Mitchell, President and CEO of Grantmakers in Health. It's my pleasure to present this podcast of Patrick Kennedy's plenary remarks at our 2015 Annual Conference on Health Philanthropy. Mr. Kennedy, who is founder of the Kennedy Forum on Community Mental Health and a former U.S. representative, passionately advocates for improved mental health treatment and insurance coverage. Here's his speech.
Thank you, Octavia, and thank you for reminding everyone in this room that I have a mental illness. Did you really need to rub it in? And thank you, Faith, for all the good work you do and all of your staff and the board members that made this conference possible. And thank you, all of you, for the work you do in our country to help advance the cause of health care for all of Americans who often fall through the cracks without the kind of support that your foundations give to try to connect those services so vitally needed by so many Americans who are left behind because the kind of government programs that were created to address their needs just aren't sufficient in doing the task. So I want to thank you for that. My, you know, one ask of this whole talk is that you include mental health in all your grant applications. I'm sure that each of you in this room can make that happen. I'm not asking you to give billions of dollars. I'd sure like to see a portion of that $10 billion go directly to, you know, mental health and substance use disorder services. But I would ask you to begin us to change the direction of the Titanic. And we're still going to hit the iceberg. We do it every single day in America with mental health. You know, Andy Hyman is the latest example where we failed. This is a guy who is a personal friend of mine who knows more about mental health and mental health policy than I dare say practically anyone else in this room, who's funded more mental health programs and suicide prevention hotlines than any other single individual responsible to fund. And at the end of the day, like 40,000 other Americans, depression took the life of our friend Andy Hyman. Like all the other 40,000 Americans, when you read about his passing, you'll read about the fact that he died suddenly. You won't read that depression took his life because of the shame and stigma that still pervades this issue. You know, when I had the chance to go around this country and try to get testimony for why we should do this thing called mental health parity, we went to family members of suicide victims, and invariably they used to come up to Jim Ramstead and I, who were the chief sponsors of this legislation, and put a book the size of the 9-inch yellow pages, put it right on the desk in front of us. So we couldn't see anyone else in the room after they put that book down. And all that book was filled with were obituaries. And when you open the book up, you could look up any one of those obituaries, and none of them said the real cause of death. They all said died suddenly, died unexpectedly. It was a real eye-opener for me, because even though I thought I knew a lot about, you know, the epidemic of mental illness and substance use disorders, it just took it home for me that even while this is an epidemic, it's one we continue to try to look away from. And so I wanted to start today by paying tribute to Andy Hyman, because, you know, he went down fighting to his very last breath to try to help people who are suffering from the very same illness that he struggled with his own life. And to think of all the difference that he made in his life helping people with these illnesses. And in effect, he was helping them in more than one way, because he was not only about getting the services to people, he was about making sure they were treated with dignity. Because you see, when we deny services to those with mental illness and addiction because we just dismiss and disregard these people because they're so offensive to all of our sensibilities. Why don't they get? They just need a good swift kick in the ass. Why don't they snap out of it? Our attitudes. They're just crazy and nuts. They're psycho. When we engage in that kind of thinking, we are marginalizing our own family members. Because you see, those people are us. They're your children and grandchildren. My father, late father passed away. He had a Matthew 25 on his mass card. And it's the only section in the Bible that talks about salvation. And in it talks about those that are there for the least one of these, my brothers and sisters, is there for me. And that goes to the heart of this. This is about being our brothers and our sisters' keeper. Because when you think about those who are most marginalized in society, they're the people, if you go to Faith's conference in Washington, D.C., you'll see a lot of your brothers and sisters, because it is an absolute epidemic of homelessness in and around the United States Capitol and the White House. You would think you wouldn't need to pass a major piece of legislation on mental health in Washington, D.C., because you can't go two blocks without walking over someone with a mental illness in Washington, D.C., and have to avert your eyes. Because you don't know what you're going to do if you look at that person that may require you to do something, and you don't know what the hell you're going to do. Because what do we do for people with mental illness? We call the cops. That's usually what people do. And that's why our jails today have more people with mental illness than any other institution in our country. By far, not even close. And we as a country tolerate this? These are people who are in active psychosis. I make a routine visit to local and county jails in this country, and I ask the sheriffs to take me in their jails, and I walk by the jail cells, and people are in active psychosis, banging their head along the bars of the jail and against the walls, and no one thinks that this is inhumane. No one thinks that this great nation of ours is better than that. That we could do more than say that there is no alternative for people with mental illness than to ultimately have to lock them up. It's shocking that we live in 2015, and this still is the state of our country. It's shocking that of all health indices, suicide continues to rise at record rates while automobile accidents go down. That opiate overdoses are overtaking traffic accidents as a leading cause of death. That suicide amongst our young people is the third leading cause of death. And that amongst young people, self-injury and self-harm have risen over 200% in the last 5 years. What in the world is happening in our country? And why in the world, as a nation, are we doing something? Why do our major healthcare organizations not want to deal with mental health because they have to treat the patient, but if you want to have a mental health issue, you've got to go down the hall? When I grew up and I learned about, you know, my uncles, you know, and what they were doing for civil rights, you know, I couldn't imagine that in my time I would be also fighting for civil rights. Fighting for the end of separate but unequal. Because you see, when you go to the healthcare system, they say, well, mental health, they go down the hall. You might as well say, you know, go down the hall and drink from the separate water fountain. You know, you're not allowed in the healthcare system. And that's routinely, we give pennies on the dollar what we give every other physical illness to treat it. We go in there early if you got diabetes. We want to catch it right away because we don't want it to get to be where you lose your eyesight and you have to get your legs amputated. Got to track that. You know what? We got to treat it like a chronic illness. We don't want you ending up with diabetic shock, so here's the medication. By the way, you got your primary care reimbursed. By the way, if you have a crisis, you go and you got that reimbursed. Not so in mental health. You know, if it's cancer, you know, you go in there, you try to get that early screening. You know, breast cancer, prostate. If you got someone with my Irish skin, you know, the dermatologists love me. You know, you go in there early and try to screen whether you have kind of skin cancer. The whole point of our healthcare system is to prevent sickness. But in mental health, what do? It would be like going to a cancer patient and saying, wait a second, we know you got cancer, but don't come back until you have stage 4 cancer, because you know our reimbursement doesn't kick in until you have stage 4. Or if it were like diabetes, wait a second here, we know all this preventive stuff works, but you know what, we're only here to treat you after you need your leg amputated and you go blind. We literally wait to people with these illnesses are at death's door before we even begin to think about treating them. It is criminal. It's criminal that we're welcoming back our returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and we have no better way to treat them for their traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress, than to say, welcome to the jailhouse. Because, my friends, more and more of our Iraq and Afghan war veterans are getting locked up because of their untreated TBI and post-traumatic stress. And you know, we don't even count the number of veterans in our jails. You're Grant Makers in Health. You love statistics. You like to use statistics to guide where your funding goes. You like to use benchmarks, right, to determine when you're making progress on an issue. Oh, this is where it was now. And after our funding, this is where it went. We don't even count the number of veterans who are spending the night in jail tonight all across America. And I came from Rhode Island. I represent CVS. I can tell you, got my little CVS card. CVS can tell me exactly what kind of toothpaste I bought last year and what to have on the counter for me as I walk in, because they got all that data. And you mean to tell me in this modern age, with everything with a barcode on it, that you can't tell me how many of our American heroes are getting locked up in jail while they're getting rerouted? These are the brave souls that fought for us, that went over to Afghanistan and Iraq and saw their friends die for us. And we have no better way to treat their service than to say, we're going to ignore you, we're going to ignore your suicide rates, we're going to allow you to drown yourself in alcohol and drugs because you have no better way to treat your illnesses. This is unconscionable. And frankly, if we can do it to our veterans, those with mental illness and addiction stand no chance. Because if there's ever a group that would win bipartisan support on Capitol Hill to rescue them, if there's any group, it's not those with severe and persistent mental illness. It's certainly not those of us who have addictions. I mean, we're like, you know, we're lucky we didn't get in the room in terms of any kind of political power. And the notion that we can't even do it for our veterans just disgusts me and should disgust every single American. So, why was I invited here, and what is it that you all can do? You already got my message. You can make sure mental health and substance disorders are somehow incorporated. So I know a lot of you are concerned with adverse childhood experiences. I was the sponsor of the Nurse Family Partnership. The most evidence-based intervention in this country is intervening with a pregnant mom who is in distress and depressed. You spend, if you had $1 left in your foundation, $1, and you were asked one place that I could put it where it would make more of a difference in changing the course of mental health in the country, I'd say, give it to the pregnant mom with the child in utero who is distressed and depressed. That would be the best dollar you could spend. And yet, we totally ignore that dollar. My wife's a school teacher. You know, kids who have these illnesses can't you know, learn. And yet, when they start the school year, what do? They get their eyes checked. They get their hearing checked. You know, they get, why do they get these checks? Well, someone figured out that maybe the kids won't be able to learn in the classroom if they can't see or they can't hear. That's why they get the physical. They got to get their inoculations before they come to school. Has anyone ever thought about making sure they get a checkup from the neck up before they come to school? Why don't we have routine checkups from the neck up when you go to your physician's office? I mean, every primary care doc, every obstetrician, every gynecologist, the notion that physicians in this country don't do routine, evidence-based examinations of people's substance use disorders and mental illness is beyond belief. I mean, it's as shocking as these videos we keep seeing pop up all over the country, like this homeless man who was just killed in Los Angeles. You're saying, not again. This is just unbelievable that we don't have a system of care in this country that treats these illnesses like anyone else. Other illnesses would be treated. So I got into Congress and I became a sponsor of the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. And I just want to tell you that I became the leader of mental health by default. You know, I first got elected to the United States, well, first I got elected to the State House in Rhode Island at the age of 21 as the youngest state legislator in the state. Then I got elected, not to be outdone by that. I didn't feel good about myself. I didn't think I had attained enough. So by the age of 27, said, I'm going to run for Congress. And so I got elected to the United States Congress at 27. And then I said, well, this doesn't make me feel good. So I'm going to run for leadership in the Democratic caucus. And at 31, I got elected to Democratic leadership. But I just want to set the record straight. None of it had to do with my last name being Kennedy. It was all my good looks and personality that got me so far in politics. But, you know, my late father was sponsored all these major pieces of legislation. You know, he was Voting Rights Act, Meals on Wheels, all of those programs my father was the principal sponsor of. ADA, chair of the committee, all this stuff. Now, because he was in the Senate for nearly 50 years, and he was chairman of the primary committees of jurisdiction over domestic policy, meaning there wasn't a bill that crossed his desk on education or health care or pensions or equality or social justice that he didn't have the opportunity to put his name on if he wanted to. Frankly, he gave those opportunities out to his colleagues. That's why they loved him so much. So I get elected, and I thought to myself, I want to be a co-sponsor of Mental Health Parity, because I wanted to take everything I'd worked on in Rhode Island, I wanted to do it on the national level. And I had been a co-sponsor of Parity in Rhode Island. And I was, you know, somewhere down in the 20s or 30s in the list of co-sponsors. Because, you know, that's the way it was. There are a lot of people ahead of me. So I got to Washington. I thought, if I'm lucky, I'll get in the top 200 list of co-sponsors, because it's 435 members of Congress. I figure I can go home, boom, boom, do a big press release that I'm co-sponsoring the top half of the Congress who co-sponsor Mental Health Parity. Can you imagine my surprise when I asked the clerk of the House where I would co-sponsor the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, something that only says that the brain ought to be treated as a part of the body. That's basically how radical this bill is. Treated the sick. The clerk of the House said, Congressman Kennedy, if you want to be sponsor, I don't see any other takers. So, as the youngest member of Congress from the smallest state in the country, Rhode Island, in case you didn't know, and in the minority party, I was the lowest guy on the totem pole. Meaning by simple seniority, others should have been there first, right? You know, in terms, they would have had prerogative to vote me, right? No one was rushing to take my place. Because you see, no one wanted the thought that they'd have to go out there and explain to their folks back home why they were the primary sponsor of the mental health and addiction equity act. I mean, that would just be too much politically for them to have to defend, because they then know the press would ask them, you know, well, do you have addiction in your family? Did you have mental health in your family? And of course, no politician wants to stand there and say, no. You know, because then everyone will say, well, he's a liar. And if he says yes, well, who is it? Right? And that kind of sense that the shame of this would be too much for a politician to be able to bear. When we had the parity bill ultimately voted on, I had my colleagues who had told me about their own personal challenges, about their daughters with eating disorders, their spouses who had tried to kill themselves, many who had had their own parents commit suicide, and they voted no on the parity legislation. And I would go up to them afterwards and say, how could you have voted no on this parity law after what we had talked about? And they said, Patrick, I don't come from your part of the country. I come from the buckle of the Bible Belt. And in my part of the country, these issues are looked upon as being, you know, moral issues, not medical issues. They're looked upon as being character issues, not chemistry issues. So, and furthermore, Patrick, if I had ever voted for that, then the press would be interested why I voted for that. And I couldn't stand the thought that they would have found out that my child had been hospitalized several times, because I would have felt that I would have been putting my child in danger, in jeopardy, because the press, if they found out about my child, they may be tempted to print a story about her, and if they did, I can't imagine the shame that she would feel bringing down the family name if they were to know that she had been hospitalized. I mean, these are honest-to-God conversations I had with colleagues of mine who told me the most heart-wrenching stories about their own families, but who wouldn't vote for the bill because they were worried about what people would say if they found out the real reason they might have an interest in supporting this legislation. So the bill passed the House. It went to the United States Senate. It sat on the desk. And something happened in the fall of 2008. You may remember, for those of you who had 401ks, you know, they dropped precipitously. The banks were bailing up. And the Congress had to do something about it. So there was this bill kicking around called the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the Toxic Asset Relief Program. It cost over $800 billion. This is no small price tag. $800 billion, one piece of legislation. And $800 billion didn't go to all the folks you served, as you know very well. It went to the people that got us in this mess in the first place, the bankers. And you can't make this up. This is how it came down. We had to give $800 billion of the taxpayers' money to the biggest banks in this country in order to try to correct the slide of our economy and keep us from slipping into a depression. Literally, that was the thing. So this was a bill no one wanted to vote for because no one wanted to defend it. But, of course, we were considering it on the floor of the House. There's 15-minute votes on the floor of the House. And the last 5 minutes of the vote, it was clear that there wasn't going to be a majority to pass this bill. You know what happened to the stock market in those 5 minutes? Dropped another 6,000 points in 5 minutes. So the country was waiting for the Congress to do something dramatic to bail out the banks. At that point, the next week, it was like we had to pass it. People were saying, we don't like it, we got to do something. So I knew, because this was the fall of 2008, if we didn't get our parity bill passed before the TARP, then guess what? After the TARP was passed, We'd all be sent home to run for re-election because none of us wanted to stick around in Washington while we're trying to get re-elected for the Congress. So my father, I called my father, I said, how are we going to get this bill passed? You know, invariably when I ever needed something passed, I call my dad. So he said, okay, well, talk to Chris. Now, Chris was his best pal in the Senate. His name was Chris Dodd. He was a big champion for Head Start, as all of you know, a big champion for children. He served on the health committee with my dad. But many of you also remember Chris Dodd because he was chairman of the banking committee. Pretty important position in the fall of 2008. So Chris said, come over and let's talk. So we talked. He says, I got just the idea of how we're going to pass this H.R. 1424. You let me take care of it. So, perfect. So, you know, I thought they just, you know, trying to get tucked in a bunch of legislation, pass it quickly. No one would debate it, just get it passed. He did something even more. He wrote the $800 billion toxic acid relief bill into H.R. 1424, the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. Which means that you're applauding not only the sponsor of parity, but the sponsor of the largest bailout. That's how things get done in Washington, D.C. Now, so it wasn't as if we woke up someday and we said, hey, wouldn't it be great if we took care of our brothers and sisters with brain illness? We passed the parity because, you know, we got it done, as they say in Washington. It wasn't because we rose up and said, it's awful that so many people are homeless, so many people are in jail, so many people are dying at their own hands. It's awful that we're not realizing our potential as a nation, that we're, you know, so many people are struggling silently, desperately. That's not the reason why we passed it. We passed it. And so what ended up happening is no one knows that it's the law of the land. And, of course, the insurance industry liked it that way because then no one was clamoring to say, I got my rights, I got my rights, you give me my rights. And for the last, for the 5 years after that, we didn't even get the White House to do a rule in applying the parity law because, of course, they were busy getting the ACA done. I give them full credit for and how busy they were doing that. So my point is, it was only last year that we had the first year where the law is a new law, the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, requiring that whether you're inpatient, in-network, outpatient, in-network, inpatient, out-of-network, outpatient, out-of-network, emergency room benefits, pharmacy benefits, that if you pay for it in any of those boxes for someone with diabetes, with someone with cancer, that you must pay in an analogous way for treatment for someone suffering from a brain illness in the same way you would treat any other organ of the body. That's the law of the land. The challenge today, and what I'll leave you with, and what, you know, we're going to leave at least 20 minutes for question and answers, is how do we define mental health and addiction services? So, you know, I used to get lots of mental health and addiction services, and yet I was a chronic relapser, and I was in and out of emergency rooms and hospitals. Because we still have a reactive sick care system. We don't have, you know, social supports. You know, they say to me after, you know, 30 days in the rehab, okay, you've got your treatment, you know, right? I'm like, yup. You're going to go to that AA meeting, right? I'm like, yup. You know, and then off I go, right? So this is the challenge. We need to define, before anyone else defines, what are the network of services? How do we bring mental health and substance use services not just leave it the purview of the specialty, but how do we bring it into healthcare? How do we make every primary care doc have the support services, in other words, the collaborative care model that has been demonstrated more effective for treating chronic illnesses of substance use disorders and mental illness by 80 randomly controlled trial studies? This is no doubt the evidence, but no one pays for it. Imagine if you could go to your general practitioner from being a kid and being getting an assessment to being older and being assessment that you would get this, and because they would be afraid to say, oh, listen, you better work on that, you have a mood issue, you need to get treated. By the way, you know, that's going to require some social supports. What, you're dislocated from your job? Okay, there may be some employment services, that's helpful too. What, you don't have housing? Guess what, we've got the person that's going to connect you to supportive housing. We know what works, but we don't pay for it because no one's ever bothered to put it together and wrap it up in a package. So we have an opportunity because as far as I can see, every single major insurer has already gotten tagged with a settlement that they're in violation of the parity law. Okay? They're all getting whacked. Because they don't know what they're supposed to pay for. I mean, we'll tell them, but it'd be easier if you all helped give them, you know, plan A. You know what? You don't have to read all the details and asterisks and appendix. All the experts say this is the best way to go. Okay, it's, by the way, it's cheaper for you. It cuts down on your cardiovascular disease patient costs, cuts down on your cancer patient costs, cuts down on every other physical health. They're not going to be coming to the ER as much with irritable bowel syndrome or chronic back pain. They're not going to be in here all the time because they got in a car accident or fell down the stairs because of their untreated alcoholism. Here's the plan. Now, what can Grantmakers help you? You can help us create the plan. So what I'm asking for is support for the kind of systems change, which is a fancy word of saying, let's give them plan A. It's not going to be hard for us to put this together with all the literature because you guys are all the ones that fund the programs out there. And give them examples of what works. And then what we'll do is then we'll hold them accountable to paying for those things, which will ultimately save them money. So that's our challenge. And I think actually Grantmakers in Health has a huge stake in this because you're going to see overall health improve dramatically if you are more effective in treating this thing called behavioral health. Because wherever you are in your life cycle, whether you have a diagnosis or not, everyone could benefit from mental health. I'll conclude with this. There's a fellow that's sitting in second row. I won't call him out, but he's one of our heroes. He's one of those people who wore the uniform of our country. He's a Green Beret. Big time, okay? So, if you can believe it, I have the honor of dedicating the Special Warfare School at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to train the SEALs and the Green Berets. I'm like, what the hell are they want me for? You know, like, I'm like this addict that's in and out of, like, you know, the poor comparison to these incredible human beings. Like, they're looking at me and going, what the world is ego talking to? It's like, well, of course, the name of the Special Warfare School is called the Kennedy Special Warfare School. So they had me come, and I went around and I got the whole debrief from the general there, oversaw it. He said, you know, Congressman, we have more mental health in the military. No branch of the service has more mental health per capita than the Green Berets. And I said, listen, this thing, you see the name on this place? It's Kennedy. I'm going to support you anyway. Okay, you don't need to give me any of this good stuff, you know, about how it's got mental health, because you know I care about that. He said, no, Congressman, I'm serious. And I said, listen, these Green Berets, they jump out of planes, and they swim under the water for 5 miles without breathing. And, you know, they come out on the beach, and they speak in 5 languages. And, you know, they take out their target. They're reading to their kid before dinner time. I mean, why in the world would they need mental health? They said, the general said, Congressman, you don't understand. And I'm like, listen, tell me, I'm Mr. Mental Health. What do I not understand? He said, we don't see this in the way you see it. I'm like, okay, now I'm waiting for it. You see, we see mental health as a force multiplier. And I'm like, damn! That's good. And I said, do you mind if I borrow that for the rest of the country? Because maybe this thing would be so stigmatized if every American thought of mental health as something that they want to have because it was going to optimize their functionality in life and let them live to their best potential. Sounds like the kind of thing most Americans would want because, you know, we all want the best. We're Americans. We're consumers. Give me. You got some of that? Yeah. That feels good? Good. Diet plan over here? Give that to me. More hair? Oh, yeah. I'll take that. Over here? Better day insurance? Yeah. More love life? Yeah, I'll take that. We want more. We want better. What's the key to all of it? Being able to optimize your functionality in life. What enables you to do that? Having better mental health so that mental health is for everyone. Sure, it's for those with severe and persistent mental illness. Sure, it's those of us who have substance use disorders. But frankly, this is a systems change that's going to help all Americans achieve their true potential and in turn will help our nation achieve its full potential. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.